King was actually a reluctant leader, a cautious academic man in his early years, who wasn't always the firebrand speaker we think of today. And being a pastor, it took him a while to warm up to the idea.
I think I describe it as a sort of a hand-me-down family business.
Stuart Burns is the author of To the Mountaintop, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Mission to Save America. When I spoke to him in 2004, he said that King, the son of a minister, spent so much time at church as a child that at first his faith was kind of hollow.
So he got in touch with the trappings. He sang in the choir. He decided to become a minister under great pressure from his father. But it wasn't until quite a while after he finished seminary and finished his PhD in theology that he actually had the conversion experience that is obligatory for a truly called Baptist.
And as the story goes, he met God in the kitchen.
He met God in the kitchen, which I think has lots of poetic resonance and meaning.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, at midnight. And he would often say later, it is midnight in our world today, but surely the morning will come. And it was midnight in his world that night because it was the darkest hour of the Montgomery bus boycott. They were facing very, very serious repression from the city authorities, and King was arrested, and he was getting death threats all the time. And he was at the end of his rope. He was really about to give up. He said he sat down at his table at midnight, his kitchen table with a cup of coffee, and he said to his God, I can't take it anymore. I cannot endure this anymore. He was at a breaking point. And then he describes it as hearing the voice of God, an inner voice that told him to fight on for justice and truth and righteousness, and that if he fought on for justice and truth and righteousness, that God would never leave him alone. And that empowered him, that emboldened him to endure the hardships and sacrifice and the death threats and the knowledge that he was going to be killed at some point during the struggle.
When did you meet King for the first time? And I know you've said that you saw in his face the visage of a holy man.
Yes, I did. I met him only once in person, and that was when I was 12 years old. He was in residence at Williams College in Western Massachusetts, where I grew up, and he preached at the college chapel on a Sunday evening, and I just happened to be walking into the church just at the moment that he was walking in, and we walked down the aisle of the church together, practically hand in hand, and I looked into his eyes, I looked into his face, and I saw this glowing face that I know may sound corny, but in fact, I saw at that very early age, I saw a holy man, and somehow that experience was a seed for me, that it led to a lifetime of involvement in social change work.
Another element in the book that you say was really important in developing his leadership for social justice and indeed his spirituality were the folks at the grassroots.
Yes, yes.
You have a great phrase on one page where you say, as a preacher and a leader, he translated into eternal diction what the people were teaching him.
Yeah. It really began during the first night of the Montgomery bus boycott when there was a mass meeting that participants have described as magical, as mystical, as sacred.
It has been moved and seconded that the resolution that read will be received and adopted. Are you ready for the question? All in favor, let it be known by standing on your feet.
And King was suddenly thrust into the center of this bus boycott, which had just begun that day, and they were having their first mass meeting that night. And he was 26 years old, and he was selected to be president of this brand new organization that was created to run the bus boycott. But he came from a kind of an academic religious background. He had just gotten his PhD in theology from Boston University. He had not gone through a conversion experience. He had a very kind of rational perspective, and he took pride in his rational perspective toward religion. Then suddenly, here he was preaching to this congregation of activists who were risking their lives and their livelihoods to boycott the buses in Montgomery. And these were people who reflected the full spectrum of Black spirituality. These were people who came from that more emotional church that frankly embarrassed Martin Luther King Jr. And suddenly, he himself was transformed in the process of giving an absolutely magnificent speech that was almost extemporaneous. He synthesized a rational approach and an emotional approach in this magnificent speech.
Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and peace. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, we will be able to live with people as our brothers.
Of course, we think of King as having an incredible commitment to nonviolence. What was the spiritual source for nonviolence? Many people believe it was Gandhi, but were there more influences than that?
As a spiritual source especially, Gandhi was almost minor. Gandhi was a source more in terms of political strategy and tactics, in terms of methodology. But the spirituality of it really did come from the black church and the black church culture. When the boycott began, he was committed to a qualified nonviolence that just had certain limits. He still believed that armed self-defense was appropriate and necessary if your own home was being attacked. So during the early days of the bus boycott, he had guns in his home. He had armed bodyguards. It was only after the patient tutoring of people like Bayard Rustin and Glenn Smiley, who were radical pacifists, who convinced him that he, as the leader, had to set a moral example of nonviolent commitment, even if all the followers didn't adhere to it. If he himself wasn't completely pure when it came to nonviolence, the followers would never even accept nonviolence as a tactic, much less as a way of life.
Then he moved from the civil rights movement into opposition to the war in Vietnam.
Yes.
How did he make that leap from a spiritual point of view?
I actually think of it as a kind of second spiritual conversion that King had when he really put his body on the line to come out swinging against the Vietnam War, because this was, in a sense, an even greater risk than to his own life than his opposition to segregation and racism. And it took a kind of a spiritual growth. King became even more devoutly religious than he had been earlier. He really embraced Jesus in the last couple of years of his life in a way that he never had before. And that emboldened him once again to take a stand that he knew in his gut would hasten his death, because it was at that point that the FBI and President Johnson declared him public enemy number one, and they were out to destroy him. Now, not necessarily to destroy him physically, but to at least destroy him psychologically, destroy him politically, and they almost did. King grew a great deal in the last 5 years of his life. He grew politically, he grew morally, and he grew spiritually.
Would you call him a liberation theologian?
Yes, in every respect that I can think of. I mean, in terms of the preferential option for the poor.
He ended his life at a garbage worker's strike.
That's right.
In Memphis.
That's right.
And in Memphis, he made a speech the night before
that's
he
right.
died.
That's right.
Which exemplified what you seem to talk about as his preoccupation with his own mortality. But that speech is where he talks about, you know, some say a long life is a good thing, but I don't worry about that now because I've been to the mountaintop.
Right.
He knew he was going to die.
Yes. I don't know if he knew he was going to die the next day, although there is a good deal of evidence that he thought he was going to die in Memphis. He had some inner sense that his life was very much nearing its end. And that great speech at Mason Temple in Memphis the night before he died is one of the great speeches of his life.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that
that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of